The Islamic Republic is showing that it is immune to their slurs and continues to act rationally and in the interests of their population, and not just their population, but in the interests of the world. They're ensuring that there's stability throughout the world and not drawing it into military adventurism as the United States, Europe, and many of the Western countries.
Thank you very much, Mr. Zakir Ahmed Mayet, attorney, activist, and political analyst from Johannesburg, and Alicia Mania, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. Thanks for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of Spotlight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Next, you will hear recitation of verse 21. Of chapter Ibrahim from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Reza Young.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبرزوا لله جميعا فقال ضعفاء للذين استكبروا إنا كنا لكم تبعا فهل أنتم مغنون عنا من عذاب الله من شيء قالوا سواء علينا أجزعنا أم صبرنا سواء علينا أجزعنا أم صبرنا ما لنا من محيص صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And they shall all come forth before Allah. Then the weak shall say to those who were proud, "Surely we were your followers. Can you therefore avert from us any part of the chastisement of Allah?" They would say, "If Allah had guided us, we too would have guided you. It is the same to us whether we are impatient now or patient. There is no place for us to fly to."
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Hezbollah leader warns against any aggression by Israel, saying any security or military measure against Lebanon will evoke an immediate response. Foreign ministers of Iran and Saudi Arabia agree to meet soon to pave the way for the reopening of the two countries' embassies. And a school shooting leaves two faculty members injured in the state of Colorado as gun violence continues unabated in the United States. Hello and welcome, everybody. The leader of Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah is warning against any aggression after Israel blamed it for a bombing attack. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah stressed that Hezbollah is not afraid to go into battle. The Hezbollah leader warned that any security or military measure against any Lebanese area or person will result in a, quote, definite and swift response. He said the bomb attack in the northern city of Megiddo indicates that Israel is in its weakest position ever. Nasrallah also warned that a war in Lebanon could spread throughout the region. According to reports, an Israeli was seriously injured when a man infiltrated Israel from Lebanon last week and planted a roadside bomb near the Megiddo Junction. The regime's military said its forces killed the suspected bomber. An Israeli minister has sparked a fierce backlash after denying the existence of Palestine. Bezalel Smotrich has also angered Jordanians for standing beside a map of Israeli-occupied territories that included Jordan. Earlier, we discussed the provocative move in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
The Jordanian parliament has voted in favor of expelling Israel's ambassador to Amman. The House of Representatives almost unanimously approved the motion. The Palestinian Parliamentary Committee and a large number of MPs had submitted several proposals asking for the expulsion. The bill now requires the approval of the Senate and signing of the Jordanian king in order to be implemented. The Israeli ambassador was summoned on Monday due to what Amman called racist and extremist behavior by the regime's finance minister. During a conference in Paris, the minister denied the existence of Palestine and stood beside a map of Israeli-occupied territories that included Jordan. To discuss that further, we're joined by Fra Hughes, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belfast, and Kevin Barrett, editor from Veterans Today, joining us from Madison. Thank you very much to both of you, gentlemen. Let's begin with Mr. Hughes. This is simply outrageous. How can someone deny the existence of an entire group of people?
Well, that's one way. By denying their existence and denying their history, you deny the reality of today. So obviously what the minister is trying to say is there has never been a Palestinian people, no culture, no independent indigenous language. And as such, if there has been no Palestinians, there's been no Palestinian state. Therefore, there is no opposition to the state of Israel being in the Middle East and in the region. So he's trying to justify the policy of occupation, which includes violence and extrajudicial murder against the Palestinian people, by simply saying they do not exist.
Our guest from Madison, Mr. Kevin Barrett, in your opinion, how will this go? We still need the approval of the Senate, the signature of the Jordanian king.
Yes, well, I would assume that the king would sign it and it will get approval, because, again, essentially the whole nation of Jordan has been disappeared by this map that the Israeli finance minister is running around showing. And, of course, this is not really unusual behavior for Israelis. It may be unusual in that an acting officer of government would be tactless enough to be doing this in public. But there's a long history of the Israelis behaving this way, stealing everything that isn't nailed down, planning to steal vastly more land than they currently have. There's an Israeli proverb that goes something, it's in Hebrew originally, but it basically says, if I don't steal it, somebody else going to steal it. So this is a nation of thieves. They know that they're living in stolen homes, on stolen land, and a lot of their national income comes from international criminal endeavors, theft, money laundering, and of course, they're the capital of human trafficking in the whole world. So this nation of criminals has not even declared official borders. People here in the United States are brainwashed by our Zionist-occupied media into believing that the U.S. is an ally of Israel and vice versa. But that's not true. There is no formal treaty of alliance. We are not an ally of Israel. And the reason for that, as the former president's daily briefer from the CIA, Ray McGovern, has said, is that Israel refuses to delineate its borders. So officially, Israel doesn't even have any official borders. Why? Because they're planning to steal more and more land. And ultimately, many of these extremists believe that God gave them everything between the Nile and the Euphrates, and they are going about the process of stealing it, just like they always steal everything that isn't nailed down. This is a nation of psychopathic criminals. Laurent Guyonneau wrote a great piece about that called Israel, the Psychopathic Nation. And it's been hidden by Google and so on, but you can find it if you work at it. Israel, the Psychopathic Nation. And this is just one more symptom. And the people of Jordan, who are under erasure, as it could be put by the Israeli government now, have no reason to accept this. And so, yes, I think this motion will be signed by the king.
Well, thank you much, Mr. Barrett. Now, Mr. Barrett actually pointed out something quite interesting, the fact that the Palestinians might be genetically more close to the people that have been referred to as Jews in the Torah and the holy books and scriptures rather than the Jews from European descent that now live in Israel. And while there is an entire culture there, there's a huge Palestinian diaspora living in different countries across the world because of the Israeli occupation. But what do you think they should do? What is now bestowed on them as some kind of duty to introduce their culture and who they are in order for such comments never to be made ever again?
Well, the culture's already there. We all know about Palestinian dance, Palestinian music, and Palestinian cuisine. But we're seeing this cultural appropriation by Zionism of everything that is ethnically Palestinian. You know, trying to say now that certain food groups that we associate with Palestinians, like falafel, is actually an Israeli dish. I have seen Israeli soldiers doing the takba dance and using haggis and things along with the dance. So, I mean, they've stolen the land, they've stolen people's homes, they've stolen the dreams, they've stolen the resources, and now they're stealing their culture. And by doing this, they are trying to condemn the Palestinian ethnicity to history. It's very much like when the white European settlers arrived in America and dislodged the indigenous population. And when it comes to being a Semite, anybody born in the land of Sham is a Semite. So all Palestinians and many Arabs are Semites. And yet these Israeli colonial settler Jews that have come from Russia and have come from America and have come from France and other white Saxon European countries, these people were like born in Russia. So you're a Russian Jew, you're not an Israeli. Maybe a Zionist by your politics, and that has brought them to Israel, but they're basically carpetbaggers that are there stealing everything, and with the cultural appropriation of Palestinian cuisine and culture, they're trying to definitely destroy the whole nature of Palestinian ethnicity. And, you know, the Palestinians are Semite people, so whenever they are brutalized, beaten, murdered, tortured, put in prison without due process, trial or charges brought forward, this is all in itself anti-Semitism. So the Israelis and Zionism in many respects has tried to totally turn the tables around, where they are the aggressors, they want to be treated as the victims. When they are the oppressors, they want to be treated as the oppressed, and they want to continue to destabilize the region. And just on that map, there's no way that Minister Smotrich did not realize the reaction that he would get from the Jordanian people and the Jordanian parliament. It also had in parts of Lebanon, I believe, and parts of Syria. And depending which ersatz Israeli map you look at, some of it actually takes in Cairo and Egypt and down as far as Saudi Arabia. So I think he's making a political statement. And the statement is his party believes that in the short term, that Israel should incorporate part of southern Lebanon, part of Syria, and all of Jordan. And the only thing that the Palestinian diaspora can do is to continue to fly the Palestinian flag and raise consciousness around the world of the continued oppression, repression, and murderous apartheid sectarian policies carried out by the Israeli government.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fra Hughes, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belfast. Also, Mr. Kevin Barrett, editor from Veterans Today, joining us from Madison. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review.
Elsewhere, Iran's foreign minister stressed the Islamic Republic's readiness to develop and strengthen relations with Saudi Arabia. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was speaking in a phone call with his Saudi counterpart Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud. He also welcomed the normalization of ties between Tehran and Riyadh. The top diplomats agreed to hold a meeting soon to pave the way for the reopening of the two countries' embassies and consulates general. Tehran and Riyadh signed a Chinese brokered deal earlier this month to normalize relations 7 years after they were severed. The two countries agreed to recommence diplomatic ties and open embassies in their respective capitals within 2 months. Well, at this year's annual UN session on human rights, victims of the anti-Iran MKO terrorist group have voiced their heartbreaking stories. On the sidelines of the event, the hope is that their testimony of suffering at the hands of this Western-backed group might eventually force a change as Western powers continue to provide the terror group with limitless support. Robert Carter was in Geneva and met with the victims.
The United Nations headquarters in Geneva once again played host to the annual Human Rights Council session on Monday, where the UN Special Rapporteur to Iran released a report on women's rights situation inside the Islamic Republic. Predictably, his views sparked major disputes with Iran's delegation over accusations of mistreatment of women in recent months following Western-backed anti-Iran riots.
Advocacy for human rights is increasingly mistaken by some states and human rights mandate holders for their unwarranted and egotistic purposes, abusing the human rights mechanisms to single out and target those nations with independent foreign policy is void of any added value for protection of human rights.
As the envoys battled it out, two Iranian onlookers had a very real story of abuse, which had been largely ignored until now. Manager Safiyari and Elham Jalizavi, two Iranian nationals who suffered horrifically following terrorist attacks on Iranian soil. The culprits, notorious anti-Iran terrorist group the MKO, an obscure cult organization which currently receives significant Western support and even maintains a presence at the UN itself via NGOs.
By providing them asylum, Western countries violated the 1951 convention, enabling them to carry on all their human rights violations, which has in turn led to our rights being violated.
Safiyari was left wheelchair-bound at 17 after an MKO bomb attack targeted a market in 1985. Jalizavi was just 15 when her father was killed in their home by an MKO mortar attack in 1991. These are just two examples of the countless Iranian victims of MKO aggression. With the help of a sympathetic non-governmental organization, the Association for Defending Victims of Terrorism, their calls for justice have now reached the heart of the UN.
The MKO are a cult who commit these acts. Their members have been duped into cooperating with them. They've also been brainwashed. Their families, too, have suffered as a result. They, too, have fallen victim to the MKO.
They should be tried in court, not allowed to come here and claim innocence. We have even filed a lawsuit with French courts because many members live in France. But unfortunately, the courts voted in their favour.
Despite past recognition of the MKO as terrorist organisation in the Western world, the US and its allies have performed a U-turn, now promoting them as legitimate opposition to the Islamic Republic, despite their many crimes against Iranian civilians.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic and the United Nations have gone through strained times, but it seems as if the UN is seemingly happy to continue providing a platform for anti-Iran terrorist organizations such as this. And as long as they do, it'll be hard to believe that ordinary Iranians will ever be able to fully trust this international institution. Robert Carter, Geneva.
Iran has once again voiced its strong opposition to continuation of the Ukraine war, declaring its readiness to help speed up resolution of the crisis. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the remark at a phone call with his Swiss counterpart, Ignacio Cassis. In a separate phone call with Austrian Foreign Minister Alexander Schallenberg, Amir Abdollahian categorically rejected Iran's involvement in the Ukraine war. He once again dismissed reports about Tehran supplying Moscow with drones for use in the war with Kiev. Amir Abdollahian said that Tehran has frequently urged Kiev to offer any documented proof it has to support its claim about the role of Iranian drones. The U.S. claims Iran is supplying drones to Russia for the war in Ukraine. Tehran dismisses the allegation, saying that drones were sent before the war as part of a military cooperation with Moscow. Gun violence seems to rage on unabated in the U.S. In the latest case, a student has shot two faculty members at a school in the western state of Colorado before fleeing the scene. The shooting happened in Denver when the 17-year-old African-American student was being patted down as part of a search for weapons. Police are trying to find his whereabouts. Officials say one of the faculty members shot in the incident is in critical condition. This is the 18th shooting at an American school this year. The country saw dozens of school shootings last year, which caused a large number of deaths and injuries. School shootings are alarmingly common in the U.S., where students are taught how to respond to an active shooter on campus. In one of the deadliest cases last May, a gunman killed 19 children and two adults in Texas. That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
When the whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless.
Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Limelight. Experts are saying President Biden's age will become a troublesome issue in the 2024 presidential race. Some White House aides are quietly keeping an eye on President Biden, who often stumbles when he walks and struggles with words during public speeches. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered this story and tells us more. A former White House doctor criticized President Joe Biden's latest physical report as alarming, saying it makes no mention of his declining mental health. U.S. Representative Ronnie Jackson, who served the Donald Trump and Barack Obama administration, said Biden's latest health report was nothing but a cover-up after the president's physical report concluded that he was a healthy and vigorous 80-year-old who is fit for office. Ronnie Jackson said the majority of Americans can see that Biden's mental health is in total decline, yet there is no transparency from the White House on what's going on, if anything, to address this issue and his inability to do his job. The latest round of warnings over the president's health comes after other White House physicians warned that Biden's results were likely sugar-coated to hide any health concerns that he might have. Joe Biden, America's oldest ever commander-in-chief, has faced serious criticism about his mental capacity following a series of high-profile gaffes, including misremembering names and dates and even failing to properly shake hands with other world leaders. His latest gaffe included stumbling in his State of the Union speech recently when he called U.S. Senator Chuck Schumer the minority leader when he is in the majority. The president's new exam included a routine physical and neurological check, which found nothing consistent with any cerebral or central neurological disorder. The physical report revealed that Biden had a lesion removed from his chest and still suffers from a stiff gait, but remained overwhelmingly positive as White House Dr. Kevin O'Connor gave the president a clean bill of health. Former White House Dr. Ronnie Jackson said that the report only further confirms that this administration is still adamant about concealing the truth. He said nowhere in the report was there mention of Biden's deteriorating mental health. Ronnie Jackson added, "This is alarming considering I have already sent three letters to the White House demanding that Joe Biden receive a cognitive test and that the results be made public, all of which have been ignored." He said everyone can see something is wrong. The cover-up needs to end. Ronnie Jackson's concern comes as both Republicans and Democrats express anxiety and worry about the president's age, who would be 82 at the time of his second inauguration if he were to win a re-election bid. Questions have emerged both during Donald Trump and Joe Biden's presidency over the two presidents' mental fitness for office, concerns that were only heightened further considering they're both senior citizens. Following a routine medical exam in November of 2021, Biden's doctor declared him fit for duty in a press release on the evaluation, which included a colonoscopy and extremely detailed neurological exam. It was the first public medical report of Joe Biden's presidency, and Dr. O'Connor addressed a couple of items that had become topics of public discourse, including his increased coughing and whether his stiff gait was indicative of neurological issues. There were no findings that which would be consistent with any cerebral or other central neurological disorder, the doctor noted at the time. Democrats remain secretly concerned but are reluctant to raise questions over Biden's fitness for office. Minnesota Democratic Representative Dean Phillips told the Politico website, "Nobody wants to be the one to do something that would undermine the chances of a Democratic victory in 2024. The Fox News Channel has also covered this story and tells us more. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, who has recently announced the run for the Republican nomination, has called for mandatory mental competency tests for politicians older than 75. During a speech launching her 2024 presidential campaign in Charleston, South Carolina, on Wednesday, 15th of February, The 51-year-old Nikki Haley targeted both Joe Biden and Donald Trump, who are 80 and 76 years old, respectively. Nikki Haley, who served as U.S. ambassador to the United Nations under Trump's presidency, said, "In the America I see, the permanent politician will finally retire. We'll have term limits for Congress and mandatory mental competency tests for politicians over the age of 75. Haley's proposal comes as voters on both sides of the aisle have expressed frustration with aged American politicians. In November, Joe Biden, the oldest man to run the country, referred to Cambodia as Colombia at an international summit in Phnom Penh led by Southeast Asian leaders, furthering concerns that the aged politician was suffering from a cognitive disorder. Joe Biden's repeated verbal stumbles and tendency to meander off script during live appearances have been seized on by Republicans as proof that he's too old for the White House. Independent observers have warned that it is very dangerous that a man with serious disturbances in cognition has his hand on the nuclear button. They have called for a mental health review of Joe Biden under the 25th Amendment, the amendment of the U.S. Constitution that deals with situations where the president or vice president are unable to fulfill their duties. On Thursday, 16th of February, Nikki Haley said she sees no reason to believe that Donald Trump would not perform well on the mental competency test. Nikki Haley said in an interview with Fox News Channel, "I think he did great the last time he did it. I have no reason to think he wouldn't do well this time, but I do think we need it." In her speech on Wednesday, 15th of February, Nikki Haley stressed that it's time for a new generation of leadership. She told the crowd gathered in Charleston, South Carolina, "We're ready, ready to move past the stale ideas and faded names of the past, and we are more than ready for a new generation to lead us into the future." She said, "America is not past our prime. It's just that our politicians are past theirs." Also in the past, Nikki Haley has suggested that aged politicians in U.S. government should undergo a cognitive test. In an appearance later on Wednesday on Fox News Channel, Nikki Haley called for generational changes when asked what differentiates her from Donald Trump. She was asked where she and Trump hold differences on issues. She responded, "Look at everything that's wrong in this country and tell me we don't need new leadership. But the difference is we need new generational leadership. We have to leave the status quo. We have to leave this chaos behind, and we've got to start talking about the future." Meanwhile, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has said the Republican presidential candidate Nikki Haley's demand for mental competency tests for politicians over the age of 75 is absurd and ageist. Bernie Sanders, an 81-year-old, told CBS's Face the Nation program, "We are fighting racism, we're fighting sexism, we're fighting extremism. I think we should also be fighting ageism." Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders has mounted two strong challenges for the Democratic presidential nomination, the first in 2016 when he was 74 years old.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome back to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we look at a trending news story which has a direct relevance to the religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective. On today's show, we're going to discuss to what extent Muslim politicians should represent their faith in public life. Here's more context on the story.
A new issue has risen for Muslims living in the West. Politicians from a Muslim background compromising on Islam in order to further their political careers. The most recent example was seen in Scotland, with Scottish Nationalist Party leadership candidate Hamza Yousaf taking the un-Islamic position of supporting same-sex relationships when questioned by journalists about his religious stance.
Just to be crystal clear on this, do you think that gay sex is a sin?
Oh, look, I've answered this question time and time and time and time again. No matter how many times, Sophie, you ask the question, I believe in equal marriage. I believe that people's marriage, if they are gay and they are married, that their marriage is no less, is no more inferior, or less, is worth less than my marriage as a heterosexual.
Other prominent examples of Muslim politicians abandoning Islamic norms include American Senator Ilhan Omar and British London Mayor Sadiq Khan, both of whom have been condemned by traditionalist Muslims for their pro-LGBT stances, among other controversial positions, including support for Israel and the Western war machine.
My name is Sadiq Khan. And now more so than ever before, I say it's with great pride, I am the Mayor of London!
Some argue that compromising is a necessary evil in order to gain Muslims political representation. However, Muslims in high office rarely ever champion issues of concern to the community, particularly Islamic positions, which are considered controversial according to Western worldviews. The issue can be so divisive between Muslims that some scholars now condone the opinion that Muslims should not engage in the democratic process of disbelieving nations. But the debate rages on.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about Muslims in public life, we have Lubaba Khalid, who is currently a Young Labour BME officer and previously was the Vice President of Welfare at the University of Westminster Student Union. Her work has centred on the attainment gap, decolonialisation of the university and anti-racism work. Lubaba, thank you so much for joining me on the show. Now, just tell me, what do you make of this story coming out of Scotland? It's obviously a difficult situation that Hamza Yousaf has been put in. It seems as if he's being focused on specifically because of his Muslim background.
That's the reality because, you know, he's running against another candidate who is a very strong Christian. I've now forgotten her name. What's her name?
Forbes,
yeah. You know, and she's a strong Christian and she was asked the same questions around, you know, gay sex and things like that. And she didn't get the same backlash as Hamza Yousaf. So one can only think that, can only come to the conclusion that the backlash that he's getting and the question that he's come is inherently from an Islamophobic position than it being about the politics that he's running on and the policies that he would like to see if elected.
It seems as if Muslims are in this rock and a hard place. They're kind of stuck where if they choose to stand by traditionalist Islamic interpretations, the kind of thing they would have been brought up to believe, then, of course, they'll become potentially persecuted. They won't be able to pursue mainstream careers, for example, like Hamza Yousaf. If he took a different position on this subject, I doubt he would have been treated so well. Mm-hmm. Even though he took a pro-Western viewpoint on this issue, he's still being grilled by the media. But I think with Forbes, the Christian alternative, she has taken some controversial positions as well from a mainstream position, but because, you know, she's white British, she's perhaps given the freedom to be controversial without this kind of like, well, her career's going to be completely destroyed as a result of that. Just tell me, as someone, as a Muslim yourself in this country who's, you know, getting involved in politics now, what's the atmosphere like for Muslims in the political sphere right now?
It's very hostile. It's hostile. it is a struggle to find the balance where we're not compromising our morals and our religion, but also wanting to create that change in society and things like that. So it is really tough. A lot of Muslim politicians that may have started off with the right politics and the right reasons and the right morals and things like that for now have been forced to accept these ideas that do contradict our religion. And we shouldn't be somewhat scared to say that. It is written in our scriptures. It is written. These things are not acceptable in Islam. But we're now in a situation where we're being forced to. But then the reality is this is not accepted in the three Abrahamic faiths as well. And I think people do forget that as well. So
it seems like, because this is obviously a secular country by and large, I think, you know, to describe as a Christian country right now is quite rich.
Yeah.
It's hard to find someone who identifies as a Christian these days.
Yeah.
So it seems as if there might be some kind of attack on religion. You mentioned quite rightly that this is a view that all the Abrahamic religions adhere to. It's not just Islam, but it seems as if anyone who is religious and pursues a public career, they can be demonized just for having those opinions, just for believing in their religion. And standing by those principles, they can be demonized. Do you think that that's the case?
I do. I feel like there is a more acceptance to attack Muslims than it would be for, let's say, Catholics or Jewish people.
Really?
I feel like there is a more acceptance that society has created with, you know, with 9/11 and the narrative around terrorism and things like that, that it's become a lot more acceptable to frame Muslims as extreme, as their religion being extreme, than it is for other religions. I think currently that's what we're really, I think that's where we are right now in terms of, yes, it might be something that's in within all three religions, but I feel like it's accepted now within society that you can be Islamophobic and you won't be challenged on it. So.
Well, for more on this subject, we've also been able to speak to the veteran journalist Yvonne Ridley, who is currently a national executive member of the ALBA Party, which is a Scottish nationalist and pro-independence party. Let's see what she had to say.
Humza Yousaf has boxed himself into a corner at the moment on mixed marriage, and you have to wonder, well, he's sounding more like a career politician than a conviction politician. Whereas one of his rivals for the First Minister leadership is Kate Forbes, who is a committed Christian, but she's obviously, looking at her background, more of a conviction politician. She has come out, drawn her red lines. I will do this, I believe in this, but I will not agree to certain issues. At the end of the day, all of these politicians, regardless of whatever faith they hold, they are representing a mixed community, people of faith and people of no faith. And so in order to represent them fairly, they can't afford to have too many red lines that are going to upset certain religious or even non-religious sensibilities. Some people might think that Muslims are on a hiding to nothing because if they embrace the fortitude of Kate Forbes, who was quite adamant about her religious position on legislation, their critics would say, oh, this is Islamism coming into it. This politician is a fundamentalist, he's an extremist, he's dangerous. And of course, we all know in Britain that Islamophobia really is a very long word for racism. And unfortunately, we know that Britain, especially in the establishment, is institutionally racist. It's just there. So politicians from the Islamic faith, especially olive-skinned politicians, wouldn't be given the same latitude that Kate Forbes has been given. In fact, her rather obstinate position non-negotiable position on same-sex marriages has earned her a lot of respect because she has stood by her guns. So it may be that her position to refuse to compromise anything that would affect her faith may actually serve her well in the end, because people do like politicians who are decisive. The danger is that Muslims will not engage, will withdraw into an Islamic bubble and not get involved in politics. And that is the last thing that we want to see. I have lived in Scotland now for more than 10 years and can see the difference between the Scottish communities and the English communities, Muslim communities. And the Scottish Muslims are very happy to wave the Scottish saltire, the blue and white flag, and celebrate the famous poet Robbie Burns, and celebrate St. Andrew's Day, which is the patron saint of Scotland. And they seem quite relaxed and able to do that. And, you know, Humza Yousaf, when he took his parliamentary oath, he swore on the Holy Quran while other ministers swore on the Bible. He swore on the Holy Quran. He was wearing a kilt in Islamic tartan. We have our own tartan in Scotland. And that message is so powerful. And what the message is saying is anyone, regardless of faith or skin colour, can take part in government. And this trickles down to kids who are looking up at these politicians and thinking, yeah, I can do that. Not just Muslims, Jews as well. Yeah. More than 40 Jewish Labour members have been, they've said, persecuted and hounded out of the party. Because since Keir Starmer arrived, we've now learned that there are two sets of Jews. There are good Jews who support Israel and are Zionists and are proud to say that they're Zionists. And then there are bad Jews who don't believe in Israel, are very hostile to human rights, abuses in Israel. And of course, they're perceived to be bad Jews and have been thrown out of the party. With the exception, I think, of one who's decided to take legal action, and the Labour Party has apologised.
Well, before we continue the studio discussion, let's take a look at what people on the streets of London have to say about this. We spoke to two Muslims to give their issues on this particular subject.
Politicians like Sadiq Khan, who were elected on a basis that we're Muslim, should not go and compromise on their religion. I feel like if you're being elected on the basis of being a Muslim and you're representing a certain group of society, you shouldn't go against what they elected you on. And as a person who studies politics, it comes with democracy and representation as well. You're voted on a basis that people will believe you're the person to put their ideas across, and once you start going against them, you shouldn't be in power.
Hi, everyone. My name is Itisham Salamikum. I'm a councillor for this area, so I'm Wembley Hill. In the 5 years that I have been elected, I haven't actually been put into a position where I've had to compromise my principles. But not because of anything else other than we are believers in justice and equality, freedom and principles of empathy and compassion. The issue that's going on there, and I have differences, let's say. I'm trying to be diplomatic with those who have a stance on particularly the situation in Israel and Palestine, which is not right, I'll be honest. Our religion tells us not to kind of judge other people, but obviously in particular instances where we can have disagreements with them and we can have conversations, and I think that should be where we are allowed to have kind of differences of opinion, but at least we should have that conversation. if we stifle debate, then that is the point where they've already lost. Mm. If they want to stifle debate on certain issues and they're not open to having those conversations, then it shows like a lack of moral strength or intellectual integrity.
What about Baroness Wazi? Someone like her, did she compromise on her Islamic principles to remain in politics?
Irrespective of whichever party you are from, you need to make sure you don't compromise on your principles. And I know that she has done a lot trying to highlight the levels of Islamophobia that are present, again, not just within the Conservative Party, but across this country. We are still a racist, sexist, misogynistic kind of country, an old imperial, colonial kind of country. We still have the remnants of that. So in terms of what she has doing, it's positive that she is highlighting it. But if she's the lone voice, and let's be honest, the Tory party are so right-wing now that they are painting Muslims as the enemy. If she is a lone voice in that battle, then she can only do so much. Again, this is, I'm trying to be as diplomatic as possible. I don't agree with a lot of what, again, she stands, she's a member of a party that I totally and vehemently disagree with. But in terms of her as a person, as an individual, if she is the only person that's doing it...
Well, there you have it. Plenty of views we've heard on this issue now. Now, obviously, the LGBT issue in Scotland is not the only example of where Muslims have entered into politics in the West, and it appears as if they've had to compromise from one degree or another. Other areas would be, say, on the Palestinian issue, the Palestinian cause. It seems like London Mayor Sadiq Khan has expressed a great interest in going to visit Israel, for example, and is very happy to do so, in his view. Ilhan Omar in the US, a Muslim senator, has voted for resolutions which are branded as pro-Israel as well, and also support for Western wars, that type of thing. So just tell me where you stand on this, Lubaba, because obviously I think most Muslims, if not all, would say that these are red-line issues. We shouldn't be compromising on Palestine and other issues.
So in your context, my mother is Palestinian, so Palestine is something I will never compromise on. I can't, because that is my identity. One thing I will never understand is when someone compromises on seeing the oppressed, because we know in Islam it is our responsibility as an ummah, as a community, to stand on the side of the oppressed. And that should not be controversial. That shouldn't be something that is striving debate or... what did the guy say that the previous on the video where, you know, having to be diplomatic about it? Mm. Personally, I don't think we do. Not on something like Palestine, especially in something like Palestine, something that's happening right now in China with the Uyghur Muslims. Syria is another example. These are issues that, no, we don't need to be diplomatic about. We should be very clear that we will stand on the side of the people that are constantly being murdered on a daily basis, that their land is being taken away from. And that's what Islam tells us to do as well. And so I get very agitated, I get frustrated, obviously as a Muslim, but I think it's mainly as a Palestinian, when I see that people get elected on the oppression of my people and then they get elected and they throw it all away. And to be fair, this is not something that I've just seen among Muslims. You see it among the white left as well, that will talk about Palestine, will be openly talk about it, but then as soon as they get into their positions, they forget about it all. And so, yeah.
Do you think then, in that case, that there is an issue here? Because, as you said, when Muslims get into politics, not talking about yourself here, but other candidates, when they get high-ranking levels in politics, they are expected to compromise on this. To be pro-Palestine, as we saw with Jeremy Corbyn, for example, can get you in a lot of hot water. So they may opt to go for a more mainstream opinion on it, which is to be impartial, if not basically pro-Israel on the subject.
Then what's the point of being in... What's the point of going up in ranks? What is the point? Then that's the question we have to ask ourselves then. Should we be encouraging Muslim representation in politics, in positions, to get them in positions of power, like, for example, Sadiq Khan as the current mayor, if that will not benefit us in any way or form and it then leads to compromise, then genuinely, and it's a question that I feel like we do need to ask ourselves, that should we be asking for that representation Because is it not worse then? Because then what happens is that you have Muslims who are in positions of these positions of power, you could say, who've compromised on their views. And then there's an expectation now for any Muslim who decides to go into those positions of power to also compromise. So then the question really is, what's the point?
It
sounds very harsh, but that's the question we have to ask ourselves. Then is there a point in encouraging Muslim representation in the current political sphere that we're in?
Do you think that we actually have Muslim representation at the moment?
No, I actually, and again, this is, I actually believe we have socialist representation who just happen to be Muslim, who just happen to be people of colour. But I think it's a very pick and choose for a lot of Muslims. Like, I understand me, and, you know, one thing we are taught in Islam is not to assume what a person's going through.
Yeah.
But I do recognise they are under a lot of pressure, an enormous amount of pressure. I do recognise that. But at the same time, it really depends on the individual. If they were elected on the basis that they were Muslim before their politics, then you have an expectation and you have a responsibility to represent being a Muslim in its whole, and you can't pick and choose when to give things up and when to, you know, do that. But if you were elected on socialist policies or Tory policies or whatever it is, but then you just happen to be Muslim, then that's a different ball game altogether in terms of that discussion. But when you, and I think that's where the conversation with Sadiq Khan comes into account, is that he did play on that Muslim card. He played on being a son of a bus driver to get votes, to then get elected and not actually do anything for that community he claimed to, that he was serving. That's where the problem comes.
For sure. I appreciate your time. Of course, this situation is ongoing, so we'll have to see how it develops. But we have reached the end of the show. But thank you very much, Lubaba, for appearing with us. And thank you to everyone at home for watching as well. This is another edition of Eye on Islam that successfully come to an end. But don't worry, we'll be back next week for another edition of the show. But for now, salamu alaikum.
Welcoming God's Month. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. The great month of Sha'ban is reaching its end, and the blessed month of Ramadan is approaching. The arrival of the spring of nature is coinciding with the arrival of the spring of the Noble Quran. God's month, Ramadan. The sweet scent of chrysanthemums and daffodils has mixed with the enlivening fragrance of the blessed Ramadan, the month of fasting. Once again, we are going to fast, to pray and supplicate before God, seeking His mercy and forgiveness. But what is fasting and who is the true fasting person? This year, as houses have been cleansed for Nowruz, youths and teenagers have cleaned mosques to welcome the blessed month of Ramadan. God says in verse 125 of chapter Baqarah, of the Noble Quran, we charged Abraham and Ishmael with the upkeep of Kaaba, saying, purify my house for those who guard around it, those who make it a retreat, and those who bow and prostrate. We'll be right back. The blessed month of Ramadan is the best time for a new beginning. The Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says in his sermon before the arrival of Ramadan, O people, God's month has turned toward you with blessing, mercy, and forgiveness. It is the month which is the best of months with God. Its days are better than all days, and its nights are better than all nights. Its hours are better than all hours. It is the month in which you have been invited to God's banquet. Your breaths are considered as glorification of God, and your sleep as worship. Your deed is accepted by God, and your prayer is answered in this month. Every banquet has its special codes and manners, and Ramadan is no exception in this regard. However, in ordinary banquets and parties, the guest and the host are humans, while in the blessed month of Ramadan, the God is the host, and the servants are his guests. Therefore, we should observe carefully the manners of this banquet. The Prophet of Islam and his Ahlul Bayt, infallible progeny, used to welcome the blessed month of Ramadan by fasting a few days before the arrival of the month. Great scholar of several centuries ago, Sayyid ibn Tawus, says in one of his books, when the blessed month of Ramadan arrived, the Prophet's face color would change and he would pray and supplicate very much. Another Muslim scholar of the 7th century AH, Abu Zakaria Yahya ibn Sharaf, writes, know that it is recommended for a person who has been granted a new bounty or a calamity has been removed from him